raised her face for a moment, looked down at her, and stroked her face and body with his hand, strangely quick and rough, as if he were tearing away a covering. "Forget," he begged in an ardent whisper. "Forget everything, my Kristen. Everything except that you are my wife, and I'm your husband." With his hand, he put out the last flame and threw himself down next to her in the dark. He was sobbing too. "I never believed, never in all these years, that we would live to see this day." Outside in the courtyard, the noise died out, little by little. Weary from the ride earlier in the day and bleary with drink, the guests wandered around a while longer for the sake of propriety, but more and more of them began to slip away to find the places where they would sleep. Ronfrid escorted the most honored guests to their beds and bade them good night. Her husband, who should have been helping her with this, was nowhere to be found. Small groups of youths, mostly servants, were the only ones remaining in the dark courtyard when she finally slipped away to find her husband and take him along to bed. She had noticed that Lavrans had grown exceedingly drunk as the evening wore on. At last she stumbled upon him as he was walking stealthily outside the farmyard, looking for him. He was lying face down in the grass behind the bathhouse. Fumbling in the dark, she recognized him. Yes, it was him. She thought he was sleeping, and she touched his shoulder, trying to pull him up from the ice-cold ground. But he wasn't asleep, at least not completely.
"What do you want?"
he asked, his voice groggy. "You can't stay here," said his wife. She held on to him, for he was reeling as he stood there. With her other hand, she brushed off his velvet clothes. "It's time for us to go to bed too, husband." She put her hand under his arm and led the staggering man up toward the farm. They walked along behind the farmyard buildings.
"You didn't look up, Ronfrid, when you sat in the bridal bed wearing the crown," he said in the same voice. "Our daughter was less modest than you were. Her eyes were not shy as she looked at her bridegroom."
"She has waited for him for 3.5 years, said the mother quietly. "After that, I think she would dare to look up."
"No, the devil take me if they've waited," shouted the father,
and his wife hushed him, alarmed. They were standing in the narrow lane between the back of the latrine and the fence. Lavron slammed his fist against the lower timber of the outhouse.
"I put you here to suffer ridicule and shame, you timber. I put you here so the muck would devour you. I put you here as punishment because you struck down my pretty little maiden. I should have put you above the door of my loft and honored and thanked you with decorative carvings because you saved her from shame and from sorrow. For you caused my Ulvil to die an innocent child."
He spun around, staggered against the fence, and collapsed against it with his head resting on his arms as he sobbed uncontrollably, with long, deep moans in between. His wife put her arms around his shoulders. "Lavrans, Lavrans!" But she could not console him. "Husband!"
"Oh, I never, never, never should have given her to that man. God help me. I knew it all along. He has crushed her youth and her fair honor. I refused to believe it. No, I could not believe such a thing of Kristen. But I knew it all the same. Even so, she is too good for that weak boy who has shamed both her and himself. I shouldn't have given her to him, even if he had seduced her 10 times, so that now he can squander more of her life and happiness."
"What else was there to do?" said Ronfrid in resignation. "You could see for yourself that she was already his."
"Yes, but I didn't need to make such a great fuss to give Erland what he had already taken himself," said Lavrans. "It's a fine husband she has won, my Kristen."
He yanked at the fence. Then he wept some more. Ronfrid thought he had grown a bit more sober, but now the drink took the upper hand again. As drunk as he was and as overcome with despair, she didn't think she could take him up to the hearth room where they were supposed to sleep. It was filled with guests. She looked around. Nearby was a small barn where they kept the best hay for the horses during the spring farm work. She walked over and peered inside. No one was there. Then she led her husband inside and shut the door behind them. Ronfrid piled the hay up all around and then placed their capes over both of them. Lavrans continued to weep off and on, and occasionally he would say something, but it was so confused that she couldn't understand him. After a while, she lifted his head into her lap. "My dear husband, since they feel such love for each other, maybe everything will turn out better than we expect." Lavrans, who now seemed more clear-headed, replied, gasping, "Don't you see? He now has complete power over her, this man who could never restrain himself. She will find it difficult to oppose anything that her husband wishes. And if she is forced to do so one day, then it will torment her bitterly, that gentle child of mine. I don't understand any longer why God has given me so many great sorrows. I have striven faithfully to do his will. Why did he take our children from us, Ronfrid, one after the other? First our sons, then little Ulvil. And now I have given the one I love most dearly, without honor, to an unreliable and imprudent man. Now we have only the little one left, and it seems to me unwise to rejoice over Romborg until I see how things may go for her." Ronfrid was shaking like a leaf. Then she touched her husband's shoulder. "Lie down," she begged him. "Let's go to sleep." And with his head in his wife's arms, Lavrans lay quietly for a while, sighing now and then, until finally he fell asleep. It was still pitch dark in the barn when Ronfrid stirred. She was surprised she had slept at all. She put out her hand. Lavrans was sitting up with his hands clasped around his knees. "Are you already awake?" she asked, astonished. "Are you cold?"
"No," he replied, his voice hoarse. "But I can't sleep anymore."
"Is it Kristin you're thinking about?" asked Ronfrid. "It may turn out better than we think, Lavrans," she told him again.
"Yes, that's what I'm thinking about," said her husband. "Well, well, maiden or wife, at least she lay in the bridal bed with the one she had given her love to. Neither you nor I did that, my poor Ronfrid."
His wife gave a deep, hollow moan. She threw herself down next to him in the hay. Lavrans placed his hand on her shoulder.
"But I could not," he said with fervor and anguish. "No, I could not act toward you the way you wanted me to, back when we were young. I'm not the kind of man."
After a moment, Ronfrid murmured in tears,
"We have lived well together all the same, Lavrans. All these years?"
"So I too have believed,"
he replied gloomily. His thoughts were tumbling and racing through his mind. That one naked glance which the groom and bride had cast at each other, the two young faces blushing with red flames, he thought it so brazen. It had stung him that she was his daughter. But he kept on seeing those eyes, and he struggled wildly and blindly against tearing away the veil from something in his own heart which he had never wanted to acknowledge. There he had concealed a part of himself from his own wife when she had searched for it. He had not been able to, he interrupted himself harshly. In the name of the devil, he had been married off as a young boy. He had not chosen her himself. She was older than he was. He had not desired her. He had not wanted to learn this from her, how to love. He still grew hot with shame at the thought of it, that she had wanted him to love her when he had not wanted that kind of love from her. That she had offered him everything that he had never asked for. He had been a good husband to her. He believed that himself. He had shown her all the respect he could, given her full authority, asked her advice about everything, been faithful to her, and they had had 6 children.
He had simply wanted to live with her without her always trying to seize what was in his heart and what he refused to reveal. He had never loved anyone. What about Ingunn, Carl's wife at Bru? Lavrans blushed in the darkness. He had always visited them when he traveled through the valley. He had probably never spoken to the woman alone even once. But whenever he saw her, if he merely thought of her, he felt something like that first smell of the earth in the spring, right after the snow had gone. Now he realized it could have happened to him too. He could have loved someone too. But he had been married so young, and he had grown wary. Then he found that he thrived best out in the wilderness, up on the mountain plateaus, where every living creature demands wide open space with room enough to flee. Wary, they watch every stranger that tries to sneak up on them. Once a year, the animals of the forest and in the mountains would forget their wariness. Then they would rush at their females. But he had been given his as a gift, and she had offered him everything for which he had never wooed her. But the young ones in the nest, they had been the little warm spot in his desolation, the most profound and sweetest pleasure of his life. Those small blonde girls' heads beneath his hand. Married off, that was what had happened to him, practically unconsulted. Friends, he had many, and he had none. War? It had been a joy, but there was no more war. His armor was hanging up in the loft, seldom used. He had become a farmer, but he had had daughters. Everything he had done in his life became dear to him because he had done it to provide for those tender young lives that he held in his hands. He remembered Kristen's tiny 2-year-old body on his shoulder, her flaxen soft hair against his cheek, her little hands holding on to his belt while she pressed her hard, round forehead against his shoulder blades when he went riding with her sitting behind him on the horse. And now she had those ardent eyes, and she had won the man she wanted. She was sitting up there in the dim light, leaning against the silk pillows of the bed. In the glow of the candle she was all golden, golden crown and golden shift and golden hair spread over her naked golden arms. Her eyes were no longer shy. The father moaned with shame. And yet it seemed that his heart had burst with blood, for what he had never had, and for his wife, here at his side, to whom he had been unable to give himself. Sick with compassion, he reached for Ronfrid's hand in the dark. "Yes, I thought we lived well together," he said. "I thought you were grieving for our children. And I thought you had a melancholy heart. I never thought that it might be because I wasn't a good husband to you." Ronfrid was trembling feverishly.
"You have always been a good husband, Lavrans."
Lavrans sat with his chin resting on his knees.
"And yet, you might have done better if you had been married as our daughter was today."
Ronfrid sprang up, uttering a low, piercing cry.
"You know? How did you find out? How long have you known?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," said Lavrans after a moment, his voice strangely dispirited.
"I'm talking about the fact that I wasn't a maiden when I became your wife," replied Ronfrid, and her voice was clear and resounding with despair. After a moment, Lavrans said, in the same voice as before,
"I never knew of this until now."
Ronfrid lay down in the hay, shaking with sobs. When the spell had passed, she raised her head. A faint gray light was beginning to seep in through the holes in the wall. She could dimly see her husband as he sat there with his hands clasped around his knees, as motionless as if he were made of stone.
"Lavrans, speak to me,"
she whimpered.
"What do you want me to say?"
he asked, not moving.
"Oh, I don't know. You should curse me, strike me.
It's a little late for that now, replied her husband. There was the shadow of a scornful smile in his voice. Ronfrid wept again.
No, I didn't think I was deceiving you. So deceived and betrayed did I feel myself. No one spared me. They brought you. I saw you only 3 times before we were married. I thought you were only a boy, so pink and white, so young and childish.
That I was, said Lavrans, and his voice seemed to acquire more resonance. And that's why I would have thought that you, who were a woman, you would have been more afraid of deceiving someone who was so young that he didn't realize.
I began to think that way later on, said Ronfrid, weeping, after I came to know you. Soon the time came when I would have given my soul 20 times over if I could have been without blame toward you.
Lavran sat silent and motionless. Then his wife continued,
You're not going to ask me anything?
What good would that do now? It was the man who... We met his funeral procession at Feginsbrekka, when we were carrying Ulvil to Nidaros.
Yes, said Ronfrid. We had to step off the road, into the meadow. I watched them carry his bier past, with priests and monks and armed men. I heard that he had been granted a good death, reconciled with God. As we stood there with Ulvil's litter between us, I prayed that my sin and my sorrow might be placed at his feet on that last day.
Yes, no doubt you did, said Lavrans, and there was that same shadow of scorn in his quiet voice.
You don't know everything, said Ronfrid, cold with despair. Do you remember when he came out to visit us at Skog that first winter after we were married?
Yes, said her husband.
When Björgolf was struggling with death? Oh, no one had spared me. He was drunk when he did it to me. Later he said that he had never loved me. He didn't want me. He told me to forget about it. My father didn't know about it. He didn't deceive you. You must never believe that. But Tron, my brother and I were the dearest of friends back then, and I complained to him. He tried to threaten the man into marrying me. But he was only a boy, so he lost the fight. Later he advised me not to speak of it, and to take you.
She sat in silence for a moment.
When he came out to Skog, a year had passed, and I didn't think much about it anymore. But he came to visit. He said that he regretted what he had done, that he would have taken me then if I hadn't been married, that he was fond of me. So he said, God must judge whether he spoke the truth. After he left, I didn't dare go out on the fjord. I didn't dare because of the sin, not with the child. And by then I had begun to love you so.
She uttered a cry, as if in the wildest torment. Her husband turned his head toward her.
When Björgulf was born, Ronfrid went on, oh, I thought I loved him more than my own life. When he lay there, struggling with death, I thought, if he perishes, I will perish too. But I did not ask God to spare the boy's life.
Lavran sat for a long time before he asked, his voice heavy and dead,
was it because I wasn't his father?
I didn't know whether you were or not, said Ronfrid, stiffening.
For a long time both of them sat there, as still as death. Then the husband said fervently,
In the name of Jesus, Ronfrid, why are you telling me this now?
Oh, I don't know.
She wrung her hands so hard that her knuckles cracked.
So that you can take vengeance on me, chase me away from your manor.
Do you think that would help me?
His voice was shaking with scorn.
What about our daughters? He said quietly. Kristen, and the little one.
Ronfrid said nothing for a moment.
I remember how you judged Erlan Nikolason, she murmured. So how will you judge me?
A long, icy shiver rippled through the man's body,
releasing some of his stiffness.
You have now. We have now lived together for almost 27 years. It's not the same thing as with a man who's a stranger. I can see that you have suffered the greatest anguish.
Ronfrid collapsed into sobs at his words. She tried to reach out for his hand. He didn't move, but sat as still as a dead man. Then she wept louder and louder, but her husband sat motionless, staring at the gray light around the door. Finally, she lay there as if all her tears had run out. Then he gave her arm a fleeting caress, and she began to cry again.
"Do you remember?"
she said in between her sobs.
"That man who once visited us while we were at Skog, the one who knew the old ballads? Do you remember the one about a dead man who had come back from the land of torment and told his son the legend of what he had seen? He said that a great clamor was heard from the depths of hell, and unfaithful wives ground up earth for their husband's food. Bloody were the stones that they turned. Bloody hung their hearts from their breasts." Lavran said nothing.
"For all these years, I have thought of those words," said Ronfrid. "Each day, I felt as if my heart were bleeding, for I felt as if I were grinding up earth for your food."
Lavrans didn't know why he answered the way he did. His chest felt empty and hollow, like a man whose heart and lungs had been ripped out through his back. But he placed his hand, heavy and weary, on his wife's head and said, "Earth has to be ground up, my Ronfrid, before the food can grow." When she tried to take his hand to kiss it, he pulled it abruptly away. Then he looked down at his wife, took her hand, placed it on his knee, and leaned his cold, rigid face against it. And in this manner they sat there together, without moving, and without speaking another word.
2. The Wife. In memory of my father, Ingvald Unset. Part 1. The Fruit of Sin. Chapter 1. On the eve of St. Simon's Day, Bard Pettersson's ship anchored at the Spit near Bergsee. Abbot Olav of Niederholm had ridden down to the shore himself to greet his kinsman Erland Nicolason and to welcome the young wife he was bringing home. The newly married couple would be the guests of the abbot and spend the night at Vig. Erland led his deathly pale and miserable young wife along the dock. The abbot bantered about the wretchedness of the sea voyage. Erland laughed and said that his wife was no doubt longing to sleep in a bed that stood firmly next to a wall. And Kristen tried to smile, but she was thinking that she would not go willingly on board a ship again for as long as she lived. She felt ill if Erland merely came close to her. So strongly did he smell of the ship and the sea. His hair was completely stiff and tacky with salt water. He had been quite giddy with joy the entire time they were on board ship, and Sir Bard had laughed. Out there at Mura, where Erland had grown up, the boys were constantly out in the boats, sailing and rowing. They had felt some sympathy for her, both Erland and Sir Bard, but not as much as her misery warranted, thought Kristen. They kept saying that the seasickness would pass after she got used to being on board. But she had continued to feel wretched during the entire voyage. The next morning, she felt as if she were still sailing as she rowed up through the outlying villages, up one hill and down the next, carried over steep moraines of clay. And if she tried to fix her eyes up ahead on the mountain ridge, she felt as if the whole countryside was pitching, rising up like waves, and then tossed up against the pale blue white of the winter morning sky. A large group of Erland's friends and neighbors had arrived at Vig that morning to accompany the married couple home, so they set off in a great procession. The horses' hooves rang hollowly, for the earth was now as hard as iron from black frost.
Steam enveloped the people and the horses. Rime covered the animals' bodies as well as everyone's hair and furs. Erlund looked as white-haired as the abbot, his face glowing from the morning drink and the biting wind. Today he was wearing his bridegroom's clothing. He looked so young and happy that he seemed radiant, and joy and wild abandon surged in his beautiful, supple voice as he rode, calling to his guests and laughing with them. Kristen's heart began quivering so strangely, from sorrow and tenderness and fear. She was still feeling sick after the voyage. She had that terrible burning in her breast that now appeared whenever she ate or drank even the smallest amount. She was bitterly cold, and lodged deep in her soul was that tiny, dull, mute anger toward Erlund, who was so free of sorrow. And yet, now that she saw with what naive pride and sparkling elation he was escorting her home as his wife, a bitter remorse began trickling inside her, and her breast ached with pity for him. Now she wished she hadn't held to her own obstinate decision, but had told Erlund when he visited them in the summer that it would not be fitting for their wedding to be celebrated with too much grandeur. And yet she had doubtless wished he might see for himself that they would not be able to escape their actions without humiliation. But she had also been afraid of her father. And she had thought that after their wedding was celebrated, they would be going far away. She wouldn't see her village again for a long time, not until all talk of her had long since died out. Now she realized that this would be much worse. Erlund had mentioned the great homecoming celebration that he would hold at Husaby, but she hadn't envisioned that it would be like a second wedding feast. And these guests, they were the people she and Erlund would live among. It was their respect and friendship that they needed to win. These were the people who had witnessed Erlund's foolishness and misfortune all these years. Now he believed that he had redeemed himself in their opinion, that he could take his place among his peers by right of birth and fortune. But he would be ridiculed everywhere, here in the villages, when it became apparent that he had taken advantage of his own lawfully betrothed bride. The abbot leaned over toward Kristen.
"You look so somber, Kristen Lavrin's daughter. Haven't you recovered from your seasickness yet? Or are you longing for your mother, perhaps?"
"Oh, yes, father," said Kristen softly. "I suppose I'm thinking of my mother."
They had reached Skaun. They were riding high up along the mountainside. Beneath them, on the valley floor, the leafless forest stood white and furry with frost. It glittered in the sunlight, and there were glints from a little blue lake down below. Then they emerged from the evergreen grove. Erlund pointed ahead.
"There you can see Husaby, Kristen. May God grant you many happy days there, my wife," he said warmly.
Spread out before them were vast acres, white with rime. The estate stood on what looked like a wide ledge midway up the mountain slope. Closest to them was a small, light-colored stone church, and directly to the south stood all the buildings. They were both numerous and large. Smoke was swirling up from the smoke vents. The bells began to chime from the church, and people came streaming out toward them from the courtyard, shouting and waving. The young men in the bridal procession clanged their weapons against each other, and with much banging and clattering and joyous commotion, the group raced toward the manor of the newly married man. They stopped in front of the church. Erlund lifted his bride down from her horse and led her to the door, where an entire crowd of priests and clerics stood waiting to receive them. It was bitterly cold inside, and the daylight seeped in through the small arched windows in the nave, making the glow of the tapers in the choir pale. Kristen felt abandoned and afraid when Erlund let go of her hand and went over to the men's side while she joined the group of unfamiliar women, dressed in their holiday finery. The service was very beautiful. But Kristen was freezing, and it seemed as if her prayers were blown back to her when she tried to ease her heart and lift it upwards. She thought it was probably not a good omen that it was Saint Simon's day, since he was the patron saint of the man whom she had treated so badly. From the church they walked in procession down toward the manor, First the priests, and then Kristen and Erlan, hand in hand, followed by the guests, two by two. Kristen was so distracted that she didn't notice much of the estate. The courtyard was long and narrow. The buildings stood in two rows along the south and north sides. They were massive and set close together, but they seemed old and in disrepair. The procession stopped at the door to the main house, and the priests blessed it with holy water. Then Erland led Kristen inside, through a dark entryway. On her right, a door was thrown open to brilliant light. She ducked through the doorway and stood next to Erland in his hall. It was the largest room she had ever seen on any man's estate. There was a hearth place in the middle of the floor, and it was so long that fires were burning at both ends. And the room was so wide that the crossbeams were supported by carved pillars. It seemed to Kristen more like the interior of a church or a king's great hall than the hall of a manor. At the east end of the house, where the high seat stood in the middle of the bench along the wall, enclosed beds had been built into the walls between the pillars. And so many candles were now burning in the room, on the tables, which groaned with precious vessels and platters, and in brackets attached to the walls. As was the custom in the old days, weapons and shields hung between the draped tapestries. The wall behind the high seat was covered with velvet, and that was where a man now hung Erlan's gold-chased sword and his white shield with a leaping red lion. Serving men and women had taken the guests' outer garments from them. Erlan took his wife by the hand and led her forward to the hearth place. The guests formed a semicircle behind them. A heavy-set woman with a gentle face stepped forward and shook out Kristen's wimple, which had wrinkled a bit under her cloak. As the woman stepped back to her place, she bowed to the young couple and smiled. Erlan bowed and smiled in return, and then looked down at his wife. At that moment his face was so handsome. And once again Kristen's heart seemed to sink. She felt such pity for him. She knew what he was now thinking. He saw her standing there in his hall with the long, snow-white wimple of a married woman spread out over her scarlet wedding gown. That morning she had been forced to wind a long woven belt tightly around her stomach and waist under her clothing before she could get the gown to fit properly. And she had rubbed her cheeks with a red salve that Fru Asild had given her. While she was doing this, she had thought with indignation and sadness that Erlan didn't seem to look at her much, now that he had won her, since he hadn't yet noticed her condition. Now she bitterly regretted that she hadn't told him before. As the couple stood there hand in hand, the priests walked around the room, blessing the house and the hearth, the bed and the table. Then a servant woman brought the keys of the house over to Erlan. He hung the heavy key ring on Kristen's belt, and as he did this, he looked as if he wanted to kiss her at the same time. A man brought a large drinking horn, ringed in gold, and Erlan put it to his lips and drank to her. "Health and happiness on your estate, my wife." And the guests shouted and laughed as she drank with her husband, and then threw the rest of the wine into the hearth fire. Then the musicians began to play, as Erlan Nikolausen led his lawful wife to the high seat, and the banquet guests sat down at the table. On the third day, the guests began to leave, and by the fifth day, just before mid-afternoon prayers, the last ones had departed. Then Kristen was alone with her husband at Huseby. The first thing she did was to ask the servants to remove all the bedclothes from the bed, to wash them and the surrounding walls with lye, and to carry out the straw and burn it. Then she had the bed filled with fresh straw, and on top she spread the bedclothes that she had brought with her to the estate. It was late at night before the work was done. But Kristen said that this should be done with all the beds on the farm, and all the furs were to be steamed in the bathhouse. The maids would have to start first thing in the morning and do as much as they could before the Sabbath. Erlan shook his head and laughed. What a wife she was. But he was quite ashamed. Kristen had not slept much on the first night, even though the priests had blessed her bed. On top were spread silk-covered pillows, a linen sheet, and the finest blankets and furs.
but underneath lay filthy, rotting straw. There were lice in the bedclothes and in the magnificent black bear pelt that lay on top. Many things she had noticed during those days. Behind the costly tapestries which covered the walls, the soot and the dirt had not been washed from the timbers. There was an abundance of food for the feast, but much of it was spoiled or ill-prepared. And they had lit the fires with raw, wet wood that offered hardly any heat and filled the room with smoke. Poor management she had seen everywhere when, on the second day, she walked around with Erlan to look at the estate. There would be empty stalls and storerooms after the celebration was over. The flower bins were almost swept clean. And she couldn't understand how Erlan planned to feed all the horses and so much livestock with what was left of the straw and hay. There was not even enough fodder for the sheep. But there was a loft half filled with flax, and nothing had been done with it. It seemed to be a large part of several years' harvest. And a storeroom full of ancient, unwashed, and stinking wool, some in sacks, and some lying loose all around. When Kristen put her hand into the wool, tiny brown worm eggs spilled out of it. Moths and maggots had gotten into the wool. The cattle were feeble, gaunt, scabrous, and chafed. Never had she seen so many old animals in one place. Only the horses were beautiful and well cared for. But none of them was a match for Guldsvein or Ringdraught, the stallion that her father now owned. Slongvanbauge, the horse that he had given her from home, was the most splendid horse in Husaby's stables. She couldn't resist putting her arm around his neck and pressing her face against his coat when she went over to him. And the gentry of Trøndelag looked at the horse and praised his strong, stout legs, his deep chest and high neck, his small head and broad flanks. The old man from Gimsar swore by both God and the fiend that it was a great sin that they had gelded the horse. What a battle horse he might have been. Then Kristen had to boast a little about his sire, Ringdraught. He was much bigger and stronger. There wasn't another stallion that could compete with him. Her father had even tested him against the most celebrated horses all the way north to this parish. Lavrans had given these horses the unusual names, Ringdraught and Slongvanbauge, because they were golden in color and had markings that were like reddish gold rings. The mother of Ringdraught had strayed from the other mares one summer up near the Boar Range, and they thought that a bear had taken her. But then she came back to the farm late in the fall, and the foal she bore the following year had surely not been bred by a stallion belonging to anyone above ground. So they burned sulfur and bread over the foal, and Lavrans gave the mare to the church to be even safer. But the foal had grown so magnificent that he now said he would rather lose half his estate than Ringdraught. Erlan laughed and said,
"You don't talk much, Kristen, but when you talk about your father, you're quite eloquent."
Kristen abruptly fell silent. She remembered her father's face when she was about to ride off with Erlan, and he lifted her onto her horse. Lavrans had put on a happy expression because there were so many people around them, but Kristen saw his eyes. He stroked her arm and took her hand to say farewell. At that time, her main thought had been that she was glad to be leaving. Now she thought that for as long as she lived, she would feel a sting in her soul whenever she remembered her father's eyes on that day. Then Kristen Lavrans' daughter set about organizing and managing her household. She was up before dawn each morning, even though Erlan protested and pretended that he would keep her in bed by force. No one expected a newly married woman to be running from one building to another long before the light of day. When she saw into what a sorry state everything had fallen, and how much she would have to tend to, then the thought shot through her mind hard and clear. If she had committed a sin to come to this place, so be it. But it was also a sin to make use of God's gifts as was done here. Shame was deserved by those who had been in charge before, along with all of those who had allowed Erlan's manor to decline so badly. There had not been a proper foreman at Husaby for the past 2 years. Erlan himself had been away from home much of the time, and besides, He had little knowledge of how to run the estate. So it was only to be expected that his envoys farther out in the countryside cheated him, as Kristen suspected they did, or that the servants at Husaby worked only as much as they pleased, and whenever and in whatever manner it suited each of them. It would not be easy now for her to restore order to things. One day she talked about this with Ulf Halldorsen, Erland's personal servant. They should be done with the threshing, at least of the grain on their own land, and there wasn't much of it, before it was time for the slaughtering. Ulf said, "You know, Kristen, that I'm not a farmer. We were to be Erland's weapons bearers, Haftor and I, and I am no longer practiced in farming ways."
"I know that," said the mistress. "But as things stand, Ulf, it won't be easy for me to manage this winter, newly arrived as I am in this northern region and unfamiliar with our people. It would be kind of you to help me and advise me."
"I can see, Kristen, that you won't have an easy time this winter," said the man. He looked at her with a little smile, that odd smile he always wore whenever he spoke to her or to Erland. It was impudent and mocking, and yet there was in his bearing both kindness and a certain esteem for her. And she didn't feel that she had the right to be offended when Ulf assumed a more familiar attitude toward her than might otherwise be fitting. She and Erland had allowed this man to be a witness to their improper and sinful behavior. Now she saw that he also knew in what condition she found herself. That was something she would have to bear. She saw that Erland, too, tolerated whatever Ulf said or did, and the man did not show much respect for his master. But they had been friends in their childhood. Ulf was from Myre, the son of a smallholder who lived near Bard Pettersson's estate. He used the familiar form of address when he spoke to Erland, as he now did with her. But that was more the custom among people up north than back home in her village. Ulf Halldorsen was quite a striking man, tall and dark, with handsome eyes, but his speech was ugly and coarse. Kristen had heard terrible things about him from the maids on the farm. When he went into town, he would drink ferociously, reveling and carousing in the houses that stood along the alleyways. But when he was home at Husaby, he was the most steadfast of men, the most capable, the hardest worker, and the wisest. Kristen had taken a liking to him.
"It would not be easy for any woman to come to this estate, after all that has gone on here," he said. "And yet, I believe, Mistress Kristen, that you will fare better here than most women might. You're not the kind to sit down and whimper and complain. Instead, you think of protecting the inheritance here for your descendants, when no one else gives any thought to that. And you know full well that you can count on me. I'll help you as much as I can. You must remember that I'm unaccustomed to farming ways. But if you will seek my counsel and allow me to advise you, then we should be able to make it through this winter, after a fashion."
Kristen thanked Ulf and went inside the house. Her heart was heavy with fear and anguish, but she struggled to free herself. Part of her worry was that she didn't understand Erland. He still didn't seem to notice anything. But the other part, and this was worse, was that she couldn't feel any life in the child she was carrying. She knew that at 20 weeks it should begin to move. Now it was more than 3 weeks past that time. At night she would lie in bed and feel this burden which was growing and becoming heavier, but which continued to be as dull and lifeless as ever. And hovering in her thoughts was all that she had heard about children who were born lame, with hardened sinews, about creatures that came to light without limbs, that had almost no human form. Before her closed eyes passed images of tiny infants hideously deformed. One horrific sight melted into another that was even worse. In the south of Gudbrandsdal, at Lista, they had a child. Well, it must be full grown by now. Her father had seen it, but he would never speak of it. She noticed that he grew distressed if anyone even mentioned it. She wondered how it looked. Oh no. Holy Olaf, pray for me. She must believe firmly in the beneficence of the Holy King. She had given her child into his care after all, With patience, she would suffer for her sins and place her faith, with all her soul, in help and mercy for the child. It must be the fiend himself who was tempting her with these loathsome sights in order to lure her into despair. But it was worse at night. If a child had no limbs, if it was lame, then the mother would doubtless feel no sign of life. Half asleep, Erlan noticed that his wife was uneasy. He folded her tighter into his arms and buried his face in the hollow of her neck. But in the daytime, Kristen acted as if nothing was wrong, and each morning she would dress carefully to hide from the house servants a little while longer that she was not walking alone. It was the custom at Husaby that after the evening meal, the servants would retire to the buildings where they slept. Then she and Erlan would sit alone in the hall. In general, the customs here on the manor were more as they had been in the old days, back when people had thralls to do the housework. There was no permanent table in the hall, but each morning and evening, a large plank was placed on trestles and then set with dishes, and after the meal it was hung back up on the wall. For the other meals, everyone took their food over to the benches and sat there to eat. Kristen knew that this had been the custom in the past. But nowadays, when it was hard to find men to serve at the table, and everyone had to be content with maids to do the work indoors, it was no longer practical. The women didn't want to waste their strength by lifting the heavy tables. Kristen remembered her mother telling her that at Sundbu they had a permanent table when she was 8 winters old, and the women thought this a great advantage in every way. Then they no longer had to go out to the women's house with their sewing, but could sit in the main room and cut and clip, and it looked so fine to have candlesticks and a few lovely vessels always standing there. Kristen thought that in the summer she would ask Erlan to put a table along the north wall. That's where it stood at home, and her father had his high seat at the head of the table. But at Jurengard, the bed stood along the wall to the entryway. At home, her mother sat at the end of the outer bench, so that she could go back and forth and keep an eye on the food being served. Only when there were guests did Ronfrid sit at her husband's side. But here the high seat was in the middle beneath the east gable, and Erlan always wanted Kristen to sit with him. At home, her father always offered God's servants a place in the high seat if they were guests at Jurengard, and he and Ronfrid would serve them while they ate and drank. But Erlan refused to do so unless they were of high rank. He had little love for priests or monks. They were costly friends, he said. Kristen thought about what her father and Sira Eirik always said when people complained about the avarice of clerics. Every man forgets the sinful pleasure he has enjoyed when he has to pay for it. She asked Erlan about life at Husaby in the old days, but he knew very little. Such and such he had heard, if he remembered rightly, but he couldn't recall exactly. King Skula had owned the manor and built it up, presumably intending to make Husaby his home when he donated Rhine Manor to the court. Erlan was exceedingly proud that he was descended from the Duke, as he always called the king, and from Bishop Nikolaus. The bishop was the father of his grandfather, Munan Biskupsen. But Kristen thought that he knew less about these men than she did from her own father's stories. At home, things were different. Neither her father nor her mother boasted of the power or prestige of their deceased ancestors, but they often spoke of them, holding out the good they knew about them as an example, and telling of their faults and the evil that had resulted as a warning. And they knew amusing little tales about Ivar Yesling the Elder and his enmity with King Svira, about Deon Ivar's sharp and witty replies, about Havard Yesling's tremendous girth, and about Ivar Yesling the Younger's wondrous luck in hunting. Lavrans told of his grandfather's brother, who abducted the Fulkun maiden from Vreta Cloister, about his grandfather, the Swedish knight Ketil, and about his grandmother, Romborg's Sunna's daughter, who always longed for her home in Vastergotaland, and who one day drove her sleigh through the ice of Lake Vanen when she was visiting her brother at Solberga. He told of his father's skill with weapons and of his inexpressible sorrow at the death of his young first wife, Kristin Sigurdsdóttir, who died in childbed, giving birth to Lavrans. And he read from a book about his ancestor, the holy Fru Aelin of Skurvde, who was blessed to become God's martyr. Lavrans had often said that he and Kristin should make a pilgrimage to the grave of the holy widow. But nothing had ever come of it. In her fear and need, Kristin tried to pray to this holy woman to whom she was bound by blood. She prayed to Saint Aelin for her child and kissed the cross that her father had given her. Inside was a scrap of the holy saint's shroud. But Kristin was afraid of Saint Aelin, now that she had shamed her lineage so terribly. When she prayed to Saint Olav and Saint Thomas for their intercession, she often felt that her laments reached living ears and sympathetic hearts. Her father loved these two martyrs of righteousness above all the other saints, even more than Saint Lavrans himself, whose name he bore, and whose feast day in late summer he always honored with a great banquet and rich alms. Kristin's father had seen Saint Thomas in his dreams one night when he lay wounded outside of Bogohus. No one could describe how loving and venerable he was in appearance, and Lavrans himself had not been able to utter anything but Lord, Lord. But the radiant bishop had tenderly touched the man's wound and promised him life and vigor so that he would once again see his wife and daughter, as he had prayed for. And yet at that time not a soul had believed that Lavrans Björgulfsson would live through the night. Well, Erland had said, one heard so many things. Nothing like that had ever happened to him, and it wasn't likely to either. He had never been a pious man like Lavrans. Then Kristin asked about the people who had attended their homecoming feast. Erland had little to say about them either. It occurred to Kristin that her husband did not resemble the people here in the countryside. Many of them were handsome, blonde and ruddy-hued, with round, hard heads, strong and stocky in build. Many of the old men were immensely fat. Erland looked like a strange bird among his guests. He was a head taller than most of the men, thin and lean, with slender limbs and fine joints, and he had black silken hair and a tan complexion, but pale blue eyes beneath coal-black brows and shadowy black lashes. His forehead was high and narrow, his temples hollowed. His nose was a little too big, and his mouth a little too small and weak for a man. And yet he was handsome. Kristin had never seen a man who was half as handsome as Erland. Even his soft, quiet voice was unlike the husky voices of the others. Erland laughed and said that his lineage was not from around here, except for his paternal great-grandmother, Ranrid Skúlasdóttir. People said that he was much like his mother's father, Gauta Erlandsson, of Skokheim. Kristin asked him what he knew of this man, but he knew almost nothing. One evening, Erland and Kristin were undressing. Erland couldn't unfasten the strap on his shoe, so he cut it off, and the knife sliced into his hand. He bled heavily and cursed fiercely. Kristin took a cloth out of her linen chest. She was wearing only her shift. Erland put his other arm around her waist as she bandaged his hand. Suddenly, he looked down into her face with horror and confusion, and flushed bright red himself. Kristin bowed her head. Erland withdrew his arm. He said nothing, and so Kristin walked quietly away and climbed into bed. Her heart thudded hollowly and hard against her ribs. Now and then she cast a glance at her husband. He had turned his back to her, slowly taking off one garment after the other. Then he came over and lay down. Kristin waited for him to speak. She waited so long that her heart seemed to stop beating and just stood still, quivering in her breast. But Erland didn't say a word, and he didn't take her into his arms. At last he hesitantly placed his hand on her breast and pressed his chin against her shoulder so that the stubble of his beard prickled her skin. When he still said nothing, Kristin turned over to face the wall. She felt as if she were sinking and sinking. He had not one word to offer her. Now that he knew she had been carrying his child these long, difficult days, Kristen clenched her teeth in the dark. She would not beg him. If he remained silent, then she would be silent too, even if it lasted until the day she gave birth. Resentment surged up inside her. But she lay absolutely still next to the wall. Erlan, too, lay still in the dark. Hour after hour they lay there this way, and each one knew that the other was not asleep. Finally, Kristen heard by his regular breathing that Erlan had dozed off. Then she allowed her tears to fall as they would, from sorrow and hurt and shame. This, she felt, she would never be able to forgive him. For 3 days, Erland and Kristen went about in this manner. He seemed like a wet dog, thought the young wife. She was burning and stony with anger, becoming wild with bitterness whenever she felt him give her a searching look, but then swiftly shift his glance, if she turned her eyes toward his. On the morning of the 4th day, Kristen was sitting in the main house when Erland appeared in the doorway, dressed for riding. He said that he was going west to Medelby and asked whether she wanted to accompany him to visit the manor. It was part of her wedding morning gift. Kristen assented, and Erland himself helped her to put on the fur-lined boots and a black cloak with sleeves and silver clasps. Out in the courtyard stood 4 saddled horses, but Erland told Haftor and Egil to stay home and help with the threshing. Then he helped his wife into the saddle. Kristen realized that Erland was now planning to speak about the matter which lay unspoken between them. Yet he said nothing as they slowly rode off, southward, toward the forest. It was now nearly the end of the slaughtering month, but still no snow had fallen in the parish. The day was fresh and beautiful, the sun had just come up, and it glittered and sparkled on the white frost everywhere, on the fields and on the trees. They rode across Husaby's land. Kristen saw that there were few cultivated acres or stubble fields, but mostly fallow land and old meadows, tufted with grass, moss-covered, and overgrown with alder saplings. She mentioned this. Her husband replied merrily, "Don't you know, Kristen? You who know so well how to tend and manage farms, that it does no good to grow grain this close to a trading port. You gain more by trading butter and wool for grain and flour from the foreign merchants."
"Then you should have traded the goods that are lying in your lofts and have rotted long ago," said Kristen. "I also know that the law says that every man who leases land must sow grain on 3 parts, but let the 4th part lie fallow. And surely the estate of the master should not be worse tended than the farms of his leaseholders. That's what my father always said."
Erlan laughed a bit and said, "I have never asked about the law in that regard. As long as I receive what is my due, my tenants can run their farms as they see fit, and I will run Husaby in the manner that seems to me best and most suitable."
"Do you think yourself wiser then," said Kristen, "than our deceased ancestors and St. Olav and King Magnus, who established these laws?"
Erland laughed again and said, "I hadn't given any thought to that. What a devilish good grasp you have of our country's laws and regulations, Kristen."
"I have some understanding of these matters," said Kristen, "because father often asked Sigurd of Lopsgard to recite laws for us when he came to visit, and we sat at home in the evening. Father thought it was beneficial for the servants and the young people to have some knowledge of such things, and so Sigurd would recount one passage or another."
"Sigurd," said Erlan.
"Oh, yes, now I remember. I saw him at our wedding. He was the toothless old man with the long, drooping nose who slobbered and wept and patted you on the breast. He was still dead drunk in the morning when everyone came up to us and watched as I put the linen wimple of a married woman on your head."
"He has known me for as long as I can remember," said Kristen crossly. "He used to take me on his lap and play with me when I was a little maiden."
Erland laughed again. "That was an odd kind of amusement, that you had to sit and listen to the old man chanting the law, passage by passage. Lavrans is unlike any other man in every way.
Usually it is said that if the tenant knew the full law of the land and the stallion knew his strength, then the devil would be a knight.
Kristen gave a shout and struck her horse on the flank. Erlan threw